Hello and welcome to Game On after a hiatus caused by me stepping awkwardly in the Charing Cross Road. I won't go any further to explain it. With me to talk about video games are Andy Robertson, the man behind Family Gamer TV.
Hello.
And Chris Donlan, a writer at Eurogamer.
Hello.
Now, Chris, what have I missed? We've been off for several weeks. What are the big things that I've missed in these weeks when we haven't been talking?
I'm trying to think about this because I don't really look after news. But let me say, the Xbox One is still not selling that well, I get the impression. Trying to think of some good news.
Dark Souls is out.
Dark Souls is out. Yeah, no, that's good news. Dark Souls 2 is out, and I gather the PC port is all right this time as opposed to last time. When it was pretty terrible.
Well, that's good news of a kind. Andy, it has been a lot busier out there in family land, hasn't it? What's been going on?
Well, my kids have been playing and loving, actually, Invisimals on various platforms. Is that something you've played?
Me, personally, no. The small person has not either, I'm afraid to say. My test bed, which is what Isabella is in these troubled times, has been playing Disney Infinity and demanding more characters for it. I think Moshi Monsters might be on the wane, but then she is 9, so she's moving out of the bracket. Oh, and the 2DS has sort of re-emerged as something that's been rediscovered, as well as the new Android tablet. That child has far too much technology. Are yours in the same sort of position?
Too much choice.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do. They do have too much choice. And the Invisimals is something that's coming into that territory of wanting to sort of tick all the boxes. So there's a Vita game that you use, you pick it up and use the camera to scan your room and you see these creatures appearing and you can catch them. There's a PlayStation 3 game that you can do cosplay, so you can battle between a Vita and the PlayStation. There's also a TV show coming and there's stickers to collect. There's a tablet game as well. So it's one of those games ticking all the boxes. But I think because of that, it's sort of higher on their radar than if it had just been, say, a Vita game on its own.
Is this the new way of family gaming, that it can't simply be one thing? It has to be a multi-channel affair.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the kids see a game and they're like, well, where are the figures? Or where's the collectible stickers that go with it? Like, what? Are they missing?
I mean, my instinct when I first played Skylanders was, where are the game tiles so I can play Skystones without the game?
Yeah, Skystones. I think that was in Giants,
that
wasn't it?
You're right. We should say, of course, at this point, that Skystones is it's a tactical game. It's based on a 3x3 grid, and you have these characters attacking other characters in the grid, and you have to be quite careful about the way you're defending and attacking and what you're leaving yourself open to. It's actually quite a nicely pitched strategic game. From the swappables. Not swappables, what are they called?
Swap Force.
Missing from Swap Force, though, wasn't it? Which was a bit of a shame, in my opinion.
It was, and potentially that's because Swap Force was with a different developer, Vicarious Visions, who had their own mini games. But yeah, I think for my kids, the Skystones game is the mini game of the series that sort of stands out. And it feels a bit strange that they haven't created a physical version. They could easily sort of cash in there and sell us a real physical Skystones game.
It would be perfect, because the way it would fit mechanically is you could have little magnets in it or a sort of a plastic square and little sort of ridges on it, and you could play it in the car. Why am I doing somebody else? I have. Why am I doing somebody else's job for them and not getting paid for it?
Yeah.
This is ridiculous. What about this, Chris, about the fact that you cannot simply be, especially in this younger market, you can't simply be a game. You must be other things as well. I mean, the title for this is Moshi Monsters, isn't it?
It's a strange one, because my daughter is 8 months old, and even before she's ever encountered games before, it has changed the way I think about these things. I went to see a Disney Infinity unveiling about a year ago, and they mentioned at the time that they were selling the discs, the kind of upgrade packs, in blind packs, so that you got random discs each time.
Mm. Yeah.
At the time, I thought that sounded quite nice, and it's only now I've got a child, I suddenly realise that's completely evil.
That's what eBay's for. I might have given that one away. You do find yourself doing that. It's terrible. The urge to Christmas, I think it was last year, my daughter was very keen on the idea of having a particular Moshling. And so I went on eBay and I bought that particular Moshling at a premium, because I thought, well, if I take a chance on blind pack after blind pack, I might be going up at a complete dead end. So I let somebody else take the pain out and buy all the sets. And then I went sort of stooped in and paid a couple of quid over the odds for the little thing in itself. I suppose the same thing is happening, Andy, or have you seen this with the discs for things like Infinity? Are people flogging those discs because they've got doubles? You don't swap it like you used to with football cards, do you?
Disney Infinity discs aren't quite so bad, because there's not that many. There are a lot, but there's not like hundreds and hundreds. And the sort of the rarity of the discs doesn't fluctuate quite as much. So what I get my kids to do is to essentially buy the ones that they can afford and then take them to school, and they do swapping in the playground, which for me is like taking in those Panini stickers from a football annual and swapping them with my friends when I was a kid. So I feel comfortable with that, whereas I wouldn't feel comfortable with them actually swapping the toy figures or the sort of physical things. But even so, if they make a good swap and they get a really good disc for something which wasn't very good, I'm half waiting for someone's parent to come knocking on the door and saying, "What's happened? Your kids ripped my kid off."
They've had too much information. They're too far ahead of the curve.
Insider dealing.
Yeah, exactly. No, when people know it is what you do. Now, looking at this recent breakout about this market, which I think is called Toys to Life, which is a new one on me.
Well, would like to call it that, yes.
Okay, well, it's some of the news, some of the games news people have picked up, Toys for Life.
Yeah.
We're looking at a market which was, well, just Skylanders in 2011, Skylanders Giants 2012, and then all of a sudden it's Infinity, Swap Force, Giants, original Skylanders in 2014. We've seen a proliferation of games of this type. Have we seen a market which is actually growing, though?
It seems to be. When you sort of challenge or talk to people, say at Toys R Us, about the tension between them pushing both Infinity and Skylanders, they seem to say that one legitimates the other and it's become this entity in its own right. And you've got other people coming into that and it's seemingly turning a good profit, certainly in terms of numbers. So you've got the Angry Birds telepods. Have you seen those?
No, I have not. Tell me more.
So it's a similar sort of setup to Infinity and Skylanders. So you have a game, it's usually a tablet game, maybe a kart racer, and then you can buy the little physical toys. And then you put them on the camera, essentially, of your tablet, and then they appear in the game, like in a similar way to Skylanders. So you're unlocking carts and characters in the game with these telepod toys. And they've sold millions, I think, of them. And they're pushing hard to do more and more games. The next one coming up is Angry Birds Stella, which is aimed at girls, I think, unfortunately with a pink heroine or hero, which my daughter wasn't too happy about. There's more and more. And Furby have come into this with their little physical add-ons you can buy for the Furby toys, which then again unlock stuff in the Furby app. They sort of realise that this is a way to make a bit of money, I guess, and create quite an interesting interaction for their players.
But if you don't do it properly, Andy, the kids will sniff you out quite fast, won't they?
Yes. It's not easy, I don't think, to get it right. And it would be easy to sort of say, oh, Activision were first and they're just cashing in on what they've done. But my take on Skylanders has always been there's been a huge amount of creativity behind these figures and the teams at Toys for Bob and Vicarious Visions who create them, that they're very tactile. You get one in your hands and you can see, oh, this is what, you know, as a child, you it's the sort of thing you'd want to own and play with. Ticking the boxes both for the physical toy and for the video game and then getting that crossover really strong is not easy to do. So I think for Activision, that was they worked really hard at that. And potentially for Disney, because you know the characters already, that works. It's a little bit easier because you already know, you know, this is a particular character from a particular movie that you already love. And so when you see the toy and see the game, you've got that connection to it already.
Yeah. You're the new dad in the conversation here, Chris. This is something you're going to have to deal with, I'm afraid to say, mate, that when they release the new Disney film and it's the first one your child has been to see, there's going to be a pressure on you to get them something from the film. I mean, are you going to be more minded to spend a couple of quid on a figure that goes with the Infinity system, for instance, than just a regular soft toy, do you think?
This is such a difficult subject, isn't it? It's on one hand, I think Infinity's been really good for Disney, a company that has historically never seemed particularly comfortable with video games. I think the last truly great one they made was probably Quackshot back on the Mega Drive, because I'm old. Yeah. And it seems that they now have this template they can kind of fit things to. And my nieces, who are roughly the right age, absolutely love it and swear that it's a good game. And again, I do believe that children can kind of sniff these things out. It's so strange working around games and then thinking about your own children and how you want them to interact with games. All I can say is that there are far bigger worries on my horizon as a new parent than the toy question, I think.
You say that now.
That's the pester power. That's the thing. Oh. Just, as long as you're happy saying no, then I think you're in safe territory. It's just if you feel like you've got to collect them all or you've got to always say yes when your child asks for something, that's when it starts becoming costly.
Yeah, I think they're levering. I do think these companies are genius for leveraging playground, the hierarchy of the psychodynamics of the playground.
Yeah.
You know, I've got all of these things. What have you got? And then, you know, it's pretty terrifying.
I probably indulge in oversupply when it comes to my daughter, if I'm quite honest. But then again, I'm in the privileged position of being someone who gets access to the game's material. So she can be an early adopter. But I don't know what the implication of that's going to be down the line for me. and for my wallet.
Just one thing I would say about these things is that, having played Disney Infinity a little bit, one thing which pleases me is it does seem to be a genuinely playful game. It's not just all brand power. It is, there's lots of imaginative stuff, and I think they are actually quite good games. So ultimately, if my kid is going to play games, I'd like her to play games which are genuinely playful, and these seem to be that.
The sandbox, which comes with, well, the toy box, as they call it, Andy. I mean, that is its great strength, isn't it?
And that's its distinctive, I think, over some of these competitors, certainly. We've just been hearing about the next Skylanders Trap Team, which is a phrase you'll be hearing over and over in the coming sort of 6-7 months. Doesn't innovate in that same way, or certainly haven't said they will. So that remains something that Disney Infinity have got over its competitors. And it lets you create your own game. So you get access almost to the developer tools. The more you've played the game, the more sort of items you've got. And you can create quite complex interactions. And my kids have got on with it much easier than I thought. I was looking at it and thinking, they're never going to do this. This is much too complicated. Turned round and they'd created a little game of football for themselves. So I was impressed.
So Little Big Planet sort of territory, but without the deep, deep work that you had to do to build a Little Big Planet level.
Because Little Big Planet is really complicated. Well, to my small mind, it is anyway. I never really got that far. But at Disney Infinity Toy Box, certainly, yeah, it seems to be much easier.
Well, let's move along and move into the past, kind of. That's a terrible way of doing a gear change in the... The SM is quite rightly frowning at me at the moment. Chris, I first encountered Dungeons & Dragons 30 years ago. The game itself first appeared 40 years ago, as we explored earlier on in the year. But you've played it for the first time. What was that like?
I took my time. It was absolutely extraordinary and wonderful and eye-opening.
Okay, eye-opening. Now, this character sheet, which I'm seeing parts of on the Eurogamer website, strength of 7, dexterity of 14, constitution of 10... I'm thinking of those numbers. I'm already thinking to myself, I'm not sure if you're with me on this one, Andy. I'm thinking thief or cleric. Which one was it?
I never know which way to go. I always wanted something that had a ranged weapon so that I didn't have to get too close to the action.
All right. You would have been an elf then. Go on. What did you go with, Chris?
Well, I went with elf. But what's interesting about those numbers is how low they all are. There were 5 of us in our party and we were all... Modern games are so good at making you feel like you are the most powerful thing in the world. And... Dungeons & Dragons does not do that at all. And it's really, really energising to be a completely feeble explorer in a fantasy world.
Yeah.
And what system of rolling were you using? How many dice were you rolling at the when you were bringing up your stats?
Now, I think it was 2d6 plus something, maybe.
Oh, right, okay. Or 3d6, not 3d6 then, no?
No, 3d, it was 3, we used 3d10 for the money. It was the system we were using was a game called Labyrinth Lore, which is based on basic Dungeons & Dragons. And I gather there was this very interesting sort of schism early on in Dungeons & Dragons when the basic and the advanced pulled apart. The advanced tried to create a theory of everything. A dungeon master could consult a rule book which would basically tell them what to do in any situation, whereas the basic was much more, it seems like it's much more like the difference between Jungian and Freudian psychoanalysis in a way. You know, Freudian, there is prescribed dogma for everything, and the Jungian, you can just kind of take a dreamy punt on what happens. We were definitely in Jungian territory.
I've never, ever considered it in that way, but that is, and this has been a long time since I sat down and first played. Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, schism is the nature of role-playing games, especially in that period. You know, you didn't like rule X. You simply ignored it when you were with that particular dungeon master, or he modified it to suit his own purposes. I mean, that's the great strength, I suppose, Andy, of these sorts of games. They are inherently plastic because they are just rules which you can all see.
Yeah, and I like that. They certainly have that over video games, that they allow the players and, I guess, the group as a whole to sort of do their own rule lawyering to decide, well, is this a rule we want to adhere to? And also, I think that they intentionally had gaps in the rules so that the players would make those decisions and make those sort of leaps of sort of conscious deciding how to play the game, because it then became your game and it was your iteration, and the rules you chose become embedded and sort of in your own lore of your party.
Exactly. I mean, it had a completely different mouthfeel, this game, for you, Chris, than anything you'd done before. What was that like?
I had in my head, I think, the idea that... Firstly, I should point out that it's terrible and shameful that I waited till I was 35 before playing Dungeons & Dragons.
Well, I think you're allowed when the game is actually older than you are to have delayed your playing of it, but go on.
It's, It's one of the few games which is older than me now. There's chess and Dungeons and Dragons and probably Go, and I think that's it. But I had in my head an idea that Dungeons and Dragons was the forerunner of video game RPGs. But what I wasn't expecting was that Dungeons and Dragons still outclasses video game RPGs in every conceivable, meaningful way. It makes video game attempts at storytelling look particularly limited. Mm. The freedom which comes from having this dungeon master who can lead you, often without you really knowing, who can arbitrate, who can decide on the fly, and who can take the things you've decided to do and turn them into mechanics if they're a good idea, is just an incredible experience. For someone who's sort of played a lot of, so many video games have been trying to tell stories over the last few years, and they always fall against the problem that you are just forced to do things that you wouldn't do in a proper story, or you're forced to fall back on mechanistic loops like killing people all the time. Dungeons & Dragons has none of these problems. It is a story which evolves meaningfully with the participants, and it was just mind-blowing in that respect.
And yet, reading one of these paragraphs, I'm reminded of Borderlands. You're saying about the rest of the cast. Dan, the torture-happy pedantic dwarf, embittered by the moment he had to cross the single word dog off his inventory. Martin, the dewy-eyed sex pest cleric, who bought a canoe to a knife fight. That is brilliant. Bertie, the warrior fool who just wanted to be a writer. And Tom, first a heroic and noble knight who got his head blown off, and second a heroic and noble knight's brother who wanted vengeance. He got it too, but not before I turned him into a heroic and noble horse, a horse that then kicked me to death. There you have it. I mean, that is the Dungeons & Dragons experience right there, isn't it, Andy? All the spectrums of randomness are available to you.
Yeah, it's the sandbox sort of thing, isn't it? But when we say sandbox in a video game space, we know that it's a sandbox with limits, and certain things happen, certain things can't happen. And it's a sandbox that doesn't respond to you like the real world, really. You know, it looks like the world, but your presence in it isn't noticed in the same way. And I think what Chris was describing there is that with a live god dungeon master in place, they can make the space very responsive to the people who are in it. For me anyway, when I've played it, and it's been a long time since I've played, it just has a really strong connection, and you come away with some of the campaigns I've played still sort of stick in my memory in a way that a video game hasn't so far,
because of the stories you tell about the experiences you had.
Yeah, and that's it, you have an experience, but then you go on telling the story afterwards, you recount it. And it's not often you do that with a video game, you know. And the games that do that, that do get you telling what happened, I think that's a really good sign.
You have brought us very, very neatly, very elegantly to EVE Online. Now, people will know that it's one of my enduring fascinations, EVE Online. I don't play it. It is a place, it is the literal sandbox where the rules are established, the rules are quite clearly expressed. But there is no DM, there is no GM out there. There are just other players who are, and you are working with them collaboratively to build stories. And that's what this has come to. If you go to Kickstarter at the moment, there is a project called A History of the Great Empires of EVE Online by Andrew Green. He's a journalist, and what he wants to do is actually produce an authoritative history of the first decade of EVE, because at the moment it's out there in various different formats, but it's partial and it's in places corrupted by the fact that the people who are telling the story have their own view on the story. So he wants to come in as a clear-eyed third party and build this book. And it has already been funded to its goal and is over 200% funded at this point. Now, when I spoke to him, I put it to him, to Andrew, that there were already reference sources here, that there were already wikis for the new player. So why did EVE need a book?
There are wikis out there, and there's actually a wiki called evehistory.net that I've been in touch with the owner of, and he is very passionate about EVE's history as well. But the problem with EVE wikis is that most of the time, the people who want to write a wiki entry are the people who are writing about themselves. And so you end up with these entries that are often very skewed and often very biased. And sometimes it's not incredibly unusual for you to read an entry where someone is mocking their own opponent in the wiki entry about that event. So there are really big flaws in the wiki format. And there is a lot of value, I think, for a neutral reporter coming at this and taking everybody's side and then coming up with what seems to be the real course of events.
So you want to be the first historian of NullSec?
I think that's correct. I kind of shy away from the phrase historian, but I think it is kind of apt. I really just view myself as somebody who wants to hear everybody's stories and then bring those stories to as many people as possible.
Last year when I was out at FanFest, I was having breakfast with a couple of guys, and they were talking about the fact that a raid that they had run on their own corporation, basically, paid for their trip to FanFest. This is something which people have a lot of trouble getting their heads around. The fact that allegiances can change on what we describe as a sixpence here in the UK. I think a dime is the American analogue of that phrase. It can be an incredibly torturous set of stories, can't it? With shifting allegiances and moments of expediency which come into it. Do you think it's going to feel much more like a real world once you've actually managed to distill all of these things down into a sort of a linear narrative?
In a lot of ways, yes. And those stories of betrayal, in a lot of ways, is the best way to use to describe some of those things where people just turn on a dime and betray people that they've been friends with for months and years. They make for some of the most amazing stories in the game. And they've turned the game into something that's far more interesting, even from a gameplay perspective, because it means that nowadays, if you're going to run a successful corporation or a player group in EVE, you have to have counterintelligence agencies. Every single one of the major corporations in the game has operatives who are working to try and identify spies or try to identify dissenters, people who are going to turn on them eventually, or to muzzle dissent as soon as it rises within their corporation. I've heard one of the most major corporations in the game actually has private detectives who work on things like tracking down IP addresses and things like that, and other sorts of sniffing out mischief before it ever becomes an issue. And that way, it even does not just feel more like a real world, but it actually spills over into the real world in some ways.
You've decided to go to Kickstarter rather than something like Patreon for this. Why? Why go to Kickstarter for this sort of project?
Because I want this to be something that's physical. I wanted it to be a physical book because I'm really passionate about making sure that this history of EVE is actually preserved. And that's a really dangerous thing to do, to try to preserve something in a digital format, because as we've found out with a lot of the EVE forums, those forums can kind of go out of date and then suddenly they're not online anymore and it becomes much, much more difficult to actually search them and get data from them. But if you have something physical, you can put it in a library and it can be properly preserved by people who are trained to preserve those sorts of things.
And are you going to try to avoid concentrating on the big beasts, people like the Mitanni?
In a lot of ways, yes. But in a lot of ways, no, because the Mitanni is the Winston Churchill, the Benito Mussolini of EVE's history. So you have to focus on those kinds of people. But at the same time, someone like the Mitanni he's very upfront about the fact that he views the bending of truth, the bending of history as part of the metagame, so to speak, of EVE Online, where he wants to make sure that history is most kind to his people. And so he won't necessarily be entirely truthful with you. And so it is really important to get many, many different sources from, you know, his allies, but also his adversaries and people who are also non-partial observers at the same time.
This year we're going to see, I think at EVE, or possibly we're going to see at EVE, A Tale of Internet Spaceships get its launch, the film which was made at FanFest last year. We might have a book next year. This game has become much more than just the game, hasn't it?
Oh yeah, very much so, very much so. And it's been more than a game for a long time, I think. And the act of telling stories about this game has been around for years and years and years since we really realized just how fascinating the stories are that come out of this game. And smaller efforts to do things like this have existed in the press for a long time to tell small, isolated stories. But it's growing. It's growing bigger all the time. Like you mentioned, the film. CCP just released a comic book in partnership with the indie publisher Dark Horse that chronicles one of the most famous events in the history of EVE as well. And they're actually in talks to do a TV show based on some of the player events as well. So it's growing exponentially all the time.
Well, that's Andy Green, and a history of the great empires of EVE Online can be found on Kickstarter. Andy, we talked about the physical that became a game and that interrelationship, and there we are again. We've got a game or an electronic asset, a thing which only exists in potentia, becoming a book, or at least part of it becoming a book. What strange times we live in.
It is strange. I mean, I haven't played EVE myself, but even just hearing about it, there is a fascination that it's obviously compelling to these people who are investing not just time and money, but sort of their financial and detective skills to what's going on in that world. It's a book that I would be interested in reading, although I'm not a player of the game.
You've just done your first proper sandbox, Chris, when you played Dungeons & Dragons. Is the sandbox of EVE one that you've dabbled with yet or might be going to?
Very, very briefly in the past, and I suspect probably not in the future because it is just so time-consuming. And
it's one of those games.
You owe it to the game to put in a great deal of time, I think. There are certainly people in our office who play it. It is a fascinating beast. I often wonder why why it manages to make so many of these stories which are somehow meaningful to the real world. And I wonder if it's partly because of it's a video game about economics, and also it is amoral as well. It is sort of amoral economics is just something which generates amazing stories.
I think Dr. IOG might take you up on the idea that it's amoral, but anyway, that's a layer of questioning far too arcane for tonight. So I'm just going to wrap it up by saying, Andy Robertson, Chris Donlan, thank you both very much for your time tonight.
Thank you.